But in this one, we're talking about the idol of experience. So, let's go ahead and start by looking at Colossians chapter 3, verses 1 to 5. Can I get a volunteer to read those? All right.
If then you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. Put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you: sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry.
Okay, so Paul is writing to some people who are Christians, and he says, look, if you are people that are following Jesus, then you ought to be concerned about the things that Jesus is concerned about. You ought to be thinking about things that have to do with where Jesus is. Jesus is in heaven, so your hope should be in heaven. You should set your mind on things that are above. And so you need to put to death those earthly things that are in you. And he names some stuff there at the end. And he says, put to death sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. So that connects to our theme of the study about idolatry. So let's start by asking this question. Just generally speaking, what is idolatry? Yeah.
The worship of a block of wood.
Okay, so very specifically, that would be one form of idolatry, right? You worship a block of wood. What about more generally? Yeah.
Maybe putting something over God.
Yeah, right. I think that's a really good definition. So if we just think about generally what is idolatry, it's when we put something in God's place. We desire it the way that we ought to desire God. Okay, what about covetousness? What is covetousness?
Wanting something that somebody else has.
Yeah, wanting something that somebody else has. And it's more than just wanting it, but it's like...
Having to have it.
Yeah, having to have it. Wanting it more than you should want it. Essentially, wanting it the way that you should want God. See? And so, really, covetousness and idolatry is really the same problem. Is you want something the way that you ought to want God. That's the problem that we're talking about. And so, for some people, idolatry is this temptation to bow down to a block of wood. Historically, you know, in the Old Testament, that's what God's people were tempted with. Even in the New Testament, that's what God's people were often tempted with. Even today, that's what people are often tempted with in some places and in some cultures. But for us, a lot of times it's not exactly that, but it's just that we want something in the same way that we should want God. In Exodus chapter 20, when Moses is delivering the Ten Commandments from God, the tenth commandment is, you shall not covet. And he goes into some specifics about things that you might covet. He says, don't covet your neighbor's house. Don't covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. So you can covet your neighbor's possessions, you can covet your neighbor's wife, you can covet your neighbor's donkey or his ox, but he says don't covet anything that's your neighbor's. What about experiences? Because that's the thing that we're talking about. Is it possible to covet your neighbor's experiences?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Like you can... Like if they go to like
covet their trip to Six Flags,
yeah,
like Hawaii or like Honolulu.
Yeah, right. So either Hawaii or Honolulu, or Six Flags. Those are all experiences that you might covet, right? You see other people doing stuff, and you think like, man, I've got to have that thing. And if I don't have that thing, if I don't do that thing, if I don't have that experience, then really I'm missing out on what life is all about. We have a term for that. What's the term? Fear of missing out.
FOMO,
right? Yeah. And so it's this idea that I got a definition of FOMO from dictionary.com. A feeling of anxiety or insecurity over the possibility of missing out on something as an event or an opportunity. And so I think that that feeling demonstrates in us that it's possible for us to covet not only things, not only people, but also experiences. We see the experiences that other people are enjoying and we think, like, man, I've really got to have that thing. Now, I think Dustin or Bill made the point that these idols that we're talking about are not just idols that tempt young people. We're all tempted by these things. But do you think that the idol of experience might be especially tempting for young people?
Yes.
Yeah, why?
Because we like to do things.
Yeah. Sure, right. Okay, so you see your friends doing stuff and you think like, hey, I've never done that. Maybe that's the thing that I need to do to really like feel satisfied, right?
Because like adults have done more things than the young people want to do.
Yeah, maybe so. So hopefully with age and experience, those of us who are older have been able to realize like some of these experiences that I thought would just be like all that are really not all that, right? But you know, social media I think plays a big part in this too. Like, isn't that what Instagram and TikTok and everything else is about? It's like, you're just showing off to everybody else. I ate this thing, I did this thing, I went to this place, I had this experience. And if you're scrolling through that feed all the time, you start to think, like, man, I really got to do some of this stuff, or else my life is just sort of, like, empty and boring. What do you think?
What's hard for me is not really, like, the experience. It's, like, the people that are there. Like,
okay.
They're going to have conversations without me. Like, it's hard to be missing out with your friends instead of, like, the experience. Like, if you've already done that, it's okay, but, like, they're going to be maybe talking about, like, stuff or that you, like, want to be talking about.
Right. Yeah, so there's going to be, like, inside jokes and stuff, and you're going to be out of the loop, right, if you miss out on those experiences. That's good. So, my point is that experience can be something that we covet. That can be something that we desire more than we ought to and begin to pursue in the way that really we should pursue God. And so covetousness can be idolatry, even in regards to experiences. There's a couple of different ways that I want us to think about the idol of experience, though. On the one hand, there are sinful experiences that can become idols to us. This one's pretty straightforward because hopefully most of us know that sin is something we want to avoid. Sin is something we want to stay away from. But even so, it can still be tempting and it can still be alluring to us. And I like the way that Peter discusses this in 2 Peter chapter 2. In 2 Peter 2, he talks about these sinful experiences, the way they look versus the way they actually are. And let me get somebody to read a few verses. So 2 Peter chapter 2, who wants to read verses 17 to 19 for us? Yeah, Ashlyn.
These are waterless springs and mists driven by a storm. For them the gloom of utter darkness has been reserved. For speaking loud, boasts of folly, they entice by sinful passions of the flesh those who are barely escaping from those who live in error. They promise corruption. They promise them freedom, and they themselves are slaves of corruption. For whatever overcomes a person, to that he is enslaved.
Okay, so Peter's dealing with some teaching. There's some people that are saying, hey, look, if you want to be a Christian, that's great. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff that you can really enjoy in life that it might, you know, be sinful, but it's really not such a big deal. Like, you know, if your body feels a certain kind of way and you want to satisfy a certain kind of desire, then you should just go for it. Do whatever feels right. And that's not really something that you should be too afraid of doing. And Peter is warning these people that, hey, these experiences that look so exciting and look so satisfying are really not as satisfying as they might seem like they are. And he illustrates it in a couple of different ways. So in verse 17, he says, these are waterless springs and mists driven by a storm. So what's the illustration of a waterless spring? What does that mean? Yeah, it's useless, right? So, like, you're out in the desert, and you're thirsty, and you're thinking, like, man, I really wish I could find something to drink, and you see a spring, you think, like, okay, this is going to be great. I'm going to go, and I'm going to get the water that I need, and I'm going to be satisfied. But then you show up to the spring, and there's not any water there. That's really disappointing.
It's, like, useless and depressing.
Right. And so the idea is that, like, sin is kind of like that. Sin is fun. Sin is exciting. If it wasn't, it wouldn't be tempting for anybody. But sin is just sort of like disappointing, ultimately. It's kind of like bubble gum. You know, you put a piece of bubble gum in your mouth, and for like 5 seconds, it's like so good and so sweet and so great. But then, like, especially those pink ones that are like little cylinders, double bubble or whatever it is. You know, it's just like 5 seconds later, it's just like bitter and rubbery, and you're ready to spit it out. And Peter's saying that's kind of the way that sin is. Is that, you know, it looks exciting, and for a minute it is, but it's just empty. It's just not very satisfying, right? Yeah.
And even if it is satisfying, it's temporary.
Right. And because it's temporary, ultimately, it really can't be satisfying. That is the point. So, yeah, good point. But he says also here in verse 19, they promise them freedom, but they themselves are slaves of corruption. So there's this idea that if you just really pursue these sinful experiences, you do whatever feels right, you define your life by like seeking pleasure and fulfillment in these ways, that seems like that's freedom. You know, freedom is you just do whatever you want. But he says that's not actually freedom, that's slavery. Why is that true? Why is it not freedom to just do whatever you want?
Because then you'll
do
bad things.
Okay, because then you'll do bad things. What did you say? Because sin is controlling you, right? And so if you're just following whatever you desire, if you're just saying like, okay, whatever I feel like doing, that's the thing that I'm going to do that today, and then I'll see how I feel tomorrow, and whatever I feel tomorrow, that's the thing that I'm going to do tomorrow, then really that's not freedom, is it? You're just being dictated by whatever desire you have. Desires change, desires come, and desires go. And who knows what you're going to want next week, but you're just going to have to wait and see and let that thing take you where it takes you. And he says, we're better than that. You know, in fact, it's not people that live like that, it's animals that live like that. People have the ability to make rational choices about what's good and what's bad. People have the ability to decide what is worth pursuing and what is not worth pursuing. Animals just do whatever they feel like. And he says, look, in verse 12, go up to verse 12. He says, these like irrational animals, creatures of instinct, born to be caught and destroyed, blaspheming about matters of which they are ignorant, will be destroyed in their destruction. So he says, look, these people want you to live like animals. And if you live like animals, you become like animals. And if you become like animals, you meet the same fate as the animals. You become somebody that's just caught up in this world and caught up in its destruction. If you go back to 1 Peter, he actually talks about the way that the rest of the world thinks about Christians, people who see through the idol of sinful experiences, while the rest of the world is just sort of worshiping those idols. Look in 1 Peter chapter 4. Can I get somebody to read verses 1 to 4? Yeah.
And therefore, Christ suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves with the same way of thinking. For whoever has suffered in the flesh is ceased from sin, so as to live for the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for human passions, but for the will of God. For the time that is past suffices for doing what the Gentiles want to do, living in sensuality, passions, darkness, orgies, drinking parties, and lawless idolatry. With respect to the slaves, they are surprised when we do not join them in the same blood of defection. And they malign.
Yeah, good. Okay. Same flood of debauchery, and they malign you. So there's some big words in that text, but really what Peter's saying is, look, the world is going to live by a lot of different sinful passions. They're going to be pursuing these sinful experiences. He talks about things like drinking, drunkenness, partying. He talks about sexual immorality. And he says, look, you're going to see your friends doing all that kind of stuff. And it's going to look really exciting. But you're people that know better. And you're going to say, like, hey, I'm not going to be doing all that stuff the world's doing because I know that that stuff is just empty. That stuff is just an idol. I have something better. And the world's going to look at you and say, that's so weird. Why don't you do what the rest of us are doing? And they're going to think it's strange that you're not doing what they're doing. But it's not because they have something better. It's because they don't realize that you have something better, right? Now, go back to 2 Peter again. 2 Peter chapter 2. You know, we've been talking about this idea that the world thinks that it's strange when you don't worship the same idols or experience that they worship. But if you look down in verses 20 through 22, he says, For if, after they have escaped the defilements of the world through the knowledge of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, they are again entangled in them and overcome, the last fate has become worse for them than the first. For it would have been better for them never to have known the way of righteousness than after knowing it to turn back from the holy commandment delivered to them. What the true proverb says has happened to them. The dog returns to its own vomit, and the sow, after washing herself, returns to wallow in the mire. So, Peter's writing to Christians, and he says, look, here's what can happen. You have found something that is really worth living your life about. You've found something that's really worth forming your life or building your life around. But if you have found that, and then you go back to the sinful passions that the world is so obsessed with, he says, really, it would be better if you had never left them in the first place. And he uses a couple of different examples to show us that. One is the sow that bathes in the mire, or after washing herself, returns to wallow in the mire. So it's this picture of like a pig, and it's nice and clean, and it's squeaky and pink and perfect. And then as soon as it gets out of, you know, the bath, it just jumps back in the mud puddle. And it's like, ah, man, what a waste, right? That one doesn't disturb me as much as the other one, though. What's the other picture? A dog returning to its vomit, right? Okay. So, yeah, you got this picture of, like, a dog. You know, sometimes we talk about the phrase, like, sick as a dog. So you got a dog that's sick. You can tell something's wrong with it. It's not feeling great. And it, like, walks across the yard, and then it just, like, bleh, you know, heaves up a big pile of vomit. And the dog's like, oh, man, that's great. I feel so much better now. And he takes a few steps, and he thinks, like, oh, man, I could really go for something to eat. That looks just appetizing. That looks great. And so he goes back to that vomit, and he just eats it up again. And it's like, that's stupid, right? That was the thing that was making you sick, and now you're going to eat the thing that was making you sick all over again. And that's really the way that it's like for us who are Christians. For us who know something better than the world knows, is that if we have vomited up that thing that was making us sick, those sinful experiences, and we found something satisfying in God, don't start getting curious to go back and taste that vomit again, right? You know that drunkenness and sexual immorality and those sinful passions are things that never brought you any kind of satisfaction or fulfillment, so don't go back to them. I think that's the point. Okay, you got a comment?
My daughter wants to fight. Does that kind of sometimes?
My cat.
She also used to eat her own poop.
Right.
My dog
used to
eat out of the cash litter box.
Mm. And so we as people know that that's stupid. We wouldn't do that. We wouldn't go back and eat our vomit. That's what dogs do. And so don't be a dog. Right. If you have realized that sinful experiences are disgusting and you've gotten rid of them, don't go back and taste them again, right? Okay, now, the thing that I really want to spend most of our time on is not the idol of sinful experiences, but the idol of non-sinful experiences. Because I think this one is actually more dangerous. Because, you know, with sin, we just know, like, okay, these things are bad. I need to stay away from them. It doesn't mean that we're not going to be tempted by them or even give in to them sometimes, but we need to be doing our best to just stay away from them. But there are non-sinful experiences that, you know, are not necessarily bad. They're actually good things. But the problem becomes when we make more of them than we should. So what would be some examples of that? Non-sinful experiences that could become idols to us. Yeah.
Sports.
Yeah, right. And I grew up playing baseball. I played baseball through high school. Loved it. Still like sports. But, you know, at a certain point in my life, I realized, like, you know, at the end of the day, we're just, like, putting a ball in a hoop. You know, it's like, there's got to be more to life than that, right? And so it's easy to lose perspective and make that more important than it should be. Yeah.
Cell phones.
Okay, yeah. So, you know, whether we're talking about communication or entertainment, social life or gaming or, like, any of that stuff, it can become something that, you know, just defines everything about who we are. What else? What about, like, the goals that you have in life? Things that you want to accomplish?
Academics,
right? Yeah. I mean, is school important? Yeah, school's important. You should do your best. You should try to make good grades. You should have goals. You know, like, at some point you're going to decide, I want to have this job, I want to have this career, and so I'm going to do whatever I need to do to try to obtain it. What about, like, family? You know, at some point in your life, you're probably going to decide that you'd like to have a husband or a wife, maybe some kids. And that's probably, possibly something that you're going to seek out. And that's a good thing. God blesses many of us with those things. But the problem is that if we're not careful, we can start to think that unless our life has those experiences, that our life is just sort of empty and meaningless. And when that happens, then we have started to make an idol out of those experiences. If you go over to the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon writes about this probably in the most detailed way of anybody. And if you look in Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verse 14, he sort of gives us his main thesis for this book. Can I get somebody to read that? Ecclesiastes 1:14. Yeah.
Ecclesiastes 1:14. Mm-hmm. I have seen all the works which I have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after the wind.
Okay, so he says, I've seen it all. I've seen everything that's done under the sun, and it's all vanity and striving after wind. So what does vanity mean?
In vain, useless.
Yeah, so it's in vain, it's useless, it's empty, it's not really satisfying. And Solomon proceeds to run a pretty robust experiment, something that most of us will probably never have the opportunity to do. But he says, look, I'm going to try all kinds of stuff and see if I can find meaning and fulfillment in these experiences. And they're not bad things, but they're just earthly things. And so in chapter 2, he starts with, like, pleasure. Look in verses 1 through 11. He says, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold of folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works, I built houses and planted vineyards for myself, I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forests of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasures of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delights of the sons of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So Solomon says, look, I tried all kinds of different stuff. I got, like, plants, I got gardens, you know, I had relationships, I had music, I had all of the experiences that life had to offer, and I found that it was all just pretty empty.
Just stuff.
Yeah, it was just stuff, right?
Just stuff.
Right.
It probably made this castle feel stuff.
The stuff.
More. Yeah, maybe so. But then he talks about, you know, like, wisdom. He talks about accomplishments. He says, you know, maybe if I was to achieve something with my life, like really accomplish something great, that would be the experience that would give my life meaning and fulfillment. And he finds that even that is vanity. And if you go all the way to chapter 11, Solomon kind of gives us a conclusion that we can live by. Ecclesiastes chapter 11, and let's read verses 9 and 10. Somebody read that for me. Yeah.
Ecclesiastes 11:9-10.
Yes.
Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these God will bring you into judgment. There, remove sorrow from your heart, and put away evil from your flesh. For the childhood and youth are vanity.
All right. So when Solomon gets to the end of this book, he says, "All right, here's my advice to young people." Does he say life is worthless? Don't worry about enjoying it. No, that's not what he says. He says, you know, follow your heart. He says, you know, it's good to enjoy life. But he says, remember that God's going to call you into judgment for the way that you live. And so I think that that's really good advice for us, is that it's good for us to follow our hearts. It's good for us to want to experience the things that life has to offer. Not the things that are sinful, but there are good things, there are blessings that we can enjoy here. Everything from work to school to relationships to accomplishments, to everything like that. But Solomon wants us to know we have to keep it into perspective. One way that I like to think about it is like with like a dog. So who here has a dog? Lots of people have dogs. Okay. All right, let me pick on somebody. All right, Joshua. Yes. All right. So do you have a boy dog or a girl dog?
Girl dog.
Girl dog. Perfect. Okay. So you like your dog, right? What do you like to do with your dog?
Take her outside.
Okay. She likes to go outside. Do you like to go for walks?
When I can.
Like to play fetch? Yeah. All right. Do you want to marry your dog?
No.
No. Okay. Why don't you want to marry your dog? I thought you liked it.
Because she's a dog.
Because she's a dog, right? Yeah. And so because she's a dog, she's not really capable of being your wife, right? Like, we understand that. But see, that's sort of the thing that Solomon is telling us about the experiences of life, is that they can be good things. They can be enjoyable things. The problem is when we try to make them into something that they're not capable of being. The only way to really enjoy having a dog is to acknowledge that it's just a dog. I mean, I love my dog. I have a good relationship with my dog. But I would never want to marry my dog because she's just a dog, right? And in the same way, we should enjoy the experiences of this life. We should have goals that we pursue. We should make the most out of the experiences that we have. But we don't need to try to make them into something more than they should be. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to enjoy them, right? So it's the same kind of thing that Solomon is telling us about our earthly experiences here. Now, part of this study is not only to say, here are the idols to avoid, but it's also to say, here is why God is different than these idols. Here's why God is actually satisfying where these idols are disappointing. And so let's go over to John chapter 4. In John chapter 4, Jesus is talking to a woman who I think has been guilty with the idol of experience. And he wants her to know that she can have something better. So can I get a volunteer to read John 4, right over here? You can read verses 7 to 15.
Is this the woman at the well?
This is the woman at the well, that's right.
7 to 15?
7 to 15, yeah.
A woman of Samaria came to draw water. Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. Then the woman of Samaria said to him, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman? For Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans." Jesus answered and said to her, "If you knew the gift of God and who says to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you a living water." The woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where is it do you get that living water? You are greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as well as his sons and his livestock." Jesus answered her and said, "Whoever drinks of this water will thirst again, but whoever drinks of the water that I shall give them will never thirst. But the water that I shall give him will become a fountain of water springing up to everyone's everlasting life. The woman said to him, Sir, give me this water, that I may not thirst, nor come here to draw.
Okay, so Jesus is talking to this woman at the well, and notice that he offers her several things. In verse 10, he offers her the gift of God, and he also offers her this living water. He also mentions down in verse 14 that she could never be thirsty again, that there's this spring of water, there's this eternal life. And by the time that they get down to verse 15, she's still thinking about like physical water. Because she thinks, like, this sounds great. Whatever you're talking about, if I could have this thing, I wouldn't have to come to the well anymore. Like, I could have running water in my house. That seems like the kind of thing you're talking about. And obviously, Jesus isn't talking about physical water. But he's talking about how she's missing something in her life. And Jesus can give her something that will satisfy what she's missing. Now, notice as you get down to verse 16, it seems like Jesus changes the subject. So Jesus said to her, Go, call your husband and come here. The woman answered him, I have no husband. Jesus said to her, You're right in saying I have no husband, for you've had five husbands, and the one you have now is not your husband. What you have said is true. And the woman said to him, Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. So think about this. I don't think that Jesus is actually switching the subject on her, but what he's doing is he's illustrating that she has been worshiping an idol of experience that hasn't ever really brought her any kind of satisfaction. What's the experience that it seems like she keeps going back to?
Relationships.
Relationships, right. Yeah, she's tried marriage 5 times, and she's 0 for 5, right? And so Jesus is showing her that, like, look, you have made an idol out of this experience. You keep thinking that if you would just get married again, that you would have everything that you want. And it turns out every time that you've gotten married, you've just gotten more and more thirsty. And Jesus says, I want to tell you that you can have something better. That there is an experience that will satisfy you. And it's not marriage. It's not any kind of physical, earthly experience. In John 14, in verse 6, Jesus says this, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. I think what Jesus is showing her is that there's a truly satisfying experience that's only possible in Him. And that is the experience of a relationship with God. You know, you can keep going to these idols, you can keep trying these earthly experiences, you can keep trying to find satisfaction in those things, but you're going to always be disappointed. It's just like what Peter said, whether it's a sinful experience, and it's just like this waterless spring that's ultimately disappointing, or whether it's like what Solomon was saying about non-sinful experiences, that if you build your life around them, you're going to be disappointed. All of those things are going to fall short, but if you know God, that's the thing that will actually satisfy you. That's the experience that actually matters. And Jesus makes a claim that's really bold, because he says, I'm the one that can do that for you. I'm the one that can help you with that. So, Jesus wants her to know that God is greater than these idols that she's been worshiping. There's another place that I want us to look at, and that's 1 Timothy chapter 6. Because I want us to talk about these things in a more practical way. So I think that these concepts are important for us to realize. But 1 Timothy 6 actually gives us some instruction that's practical about how we might know if we're making an idol out of an experience. So let me get somebody to read that for us. 1 Timothy 6, 6 to 12. Yeah. Yes, please.
Now godliness with company is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry up nothing out. And having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men into destruction and perdition. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith of the greediness of their greediness, and pierced themselves through with many sorrows.
All right. So, would you read through verse 10? Can you read 11 and 12 also?
But you, O man of God, believe these things and pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, and gentleness. Fight the good fight of faith. Lay hold on eternal life, to which you are also called, and have confessed the good confession in the presence of many witnesses.
Okay, thank you. So, when Paul is warning Timothy here, what's he warning him about? What's the idol that he says you need to watch out for? What's the temptation? Yeah?
Riches.
Riches, right? But it's not really riches. What is it? Like, what, more specifically.
What your neighbor has.
Yeah, so it kind of comes down to covetousness, right? Like, you are wanting the riches that your neighbor has. But really specifically, he's talking about the love of money. You know, it's not money itself that's the issue, but it's the love of money. It's this desire to be rich, right? Which is covetousness, like we were talking about earlier. What is it about money that is alluring? Why do people want money?
Then you can get nice things.
Yeah, if you have it, you can get nice things.
It also can make you popular, like, wow, this guy is so rich.
Right. So there's popularity that might come with it. You know, it seems like life would be a lot simpler if you didn't have to always think about how much stuff costs. You know, like, whatever you want, you just get it.
Laziness.
Yeah, it can cause laziness. So that can relate to the other one of the other classes that you had. But really, money is more about an experience than the money, right? Because, like, nobody just wants a pile of cash or a pile of coins so that they can, like, you know, sit on it like a dragon or, you know, swim in it, right? I mean, like, the real allure of money is the experience of being wealthy, the experience of being able to just get what you want, do what you want, and afford it, right? Okay, now, Paul warns Timothy about that idol. And he gives them some guidelines, I think, to say, this is how you know if you're starting to make an idol out of that experience. The first thing is to notice what he says here in verse 6 through 8. He says, godliness with contentment is great gain. We brought nothing into the world. We cannot take anything out. If we have food and clothing with these, we'll be content. One way that you can know that something has become an idol to you is when you feel like you can't be content without it. So, when we think about the idols of experience, especially those non-sinful experiences that we talked about earlier, it's good to want to have a certain job. It's good to pursue, you know, good grades. It's good to even pursue having a husband or a wife or a family someday. But one thing we need to realize is we need to be able to be content without those things. God hasn't promised us those things. God hasn't promised you that you're going to have that job that you always wanted. God hasn't promised you that you're going to have that family that you've always wanted. And what it means that those things are not idols to us is that we have to be content even if we don't get those things. So that's something that can be a hard check for us. Now, another thing that I think illustrates that something has become an idol for us is what he says in verse 9. Those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. Another way that you know that some experience has become an idol to you is when you think that you'll be satisfied if you get it. You know, if I could only have this one thing, if I could only achieve this one thing, if I could only do this one thing, I could scratch that itch, and then I'll be satisfied. What's the problem with that?
When you scratch an itch, the itch gets worse.
Sometimes, right.
Poison ivy.
Yeah, poison ivy does that.
You won't be content at all.
Yeah, you're always going to want a little bit more, right? Isn't that...
Poison ivy, you kind of consider like poison ivy, so like, you scratch the itch. We're going for, like, a little bit more, come back.
Yeah, okay, so poison ivy might be a good
thing. And then
it'll
be like spread
it.
And then it'll be like you itch it, and then there's always another itch. Like, I did this, I wonder what I should do next. And then you can't do without the next thing, and then you do it, and then it happens over and over again.
How many husbands did that woman need to be satisfied in John 4?
Five.
At least five, but five didn't do it, so maybe number six would do it. That's kind of what she was thinking, right? Yeah, that's right. But, or how much money would it take for you to be satisfied?
$0.
Somebody give me a number. How much money, if you could just have that amount of money, do you think would be enough?
Infinity.
Billion.
All right, so somebody said a million, I think?
Infinity.
All right, so what about a million and one? Or a million and two? Or a million and three? See, like, there's always a little bit more that you might want. And so the way that Jesus illustrated it to that woman when he talked about water. You know, you think about, like, drinking salt water. It's just going to make you more and more thirsty. The desire for earthly things is kind of like that. That the more you get, the more you think that you're almost where you need to be, if only you could get a little more. That's the temptation. And so he wants us to realize that these idols are like that. You think that you'll be satisfied if you get it, but really it just plunges you into senseless and harmful desires, plunging you into ruin and destruction. But then the third thing is what he says in verse 10. The love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. It's through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pains. So a third indication that something has become an idol to us is if our cravings for it lead us away from the faith. So if something has, if there's become an idol of experience in your life, how might that lead you away from the faith?
Like if you experience something like fun with your friends, and you like it so much that you just have to keep doing it again and again and again.
Yeah, and then you start to make sacrifices, right? Like when you have to choose between doing that fun thing with your friends or going to church, right? You choose doing the fun thing with your friends. That shows that it's become an idol. It's become more important to you than God.
Yeah. I was just going to say, you said an experience that can lead you away from being a Christian. I just thought when you're old enough, alcohol, because it just gets...
Right, and that would be one of those sinful experiences that we talked about, that, you know, the world makes you think, like, man, this is really what I need to do to have fun. And you start to choose worldly things over godly things. And that means that those things have become idols. So, you know, even with non-sinful things, though, like school, you know, you want a certain kind of career or you want to make good grades or whatever. You know, you start to just, like, build your whole life around your studies. It's good to do your best in school. But don't let your studies in school become more important to you than your studies in God's Word. You know, that's one way that that could become an idol, and it could lead you away from the faith. And so, you know, Paul tells Timothy, these are ways that you can know that if something is doing these things to you, that it's really become an idol to you. It's something that's become more important to you than God. You're guilty of covetousness. If you think you can't be content without it, you think that you'll be satisfied if you get it, and your cravings for it lead you away from the faith. But notice that he also gives some practical things in verses 11 and 12. He doesn't just say flee these things. He does say that. But then he says pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, steadfastness, gentleness. Fight the good fight of the faith. Take hold of the eternal life to which you were called. You know, he's telling him that if you realize what really is valuable, you realize that the experience of knowing God is what really matters, then pursue that thing. Decide what to be and go be it. And I think that's really empowering for young people, is that you can decide what kind of person you want to be. You can decide whether you want to be a worldly person that's shaped by the world, or whether you want to be a godly person that's shaped by God. But if you know the good thing, then pursue it. Fight for it. Work hard at it. Don't let the idols of the world distract you from what really matters. A couple other places that I want us to think about before we wrap up today. Philippians chapter 3. Paul warns about the difference between people who make physical experiences their idols versus those who make spiritual experiences the things that they're pursuing. And he talks about, in verse 18, for many of whom I've often told you and now tell you even with tears, walk as enemies of the cross of Christ. Their end is destruction. Their God is their belly, and they glory in their shame with mindset on earthly things. Paul's warning these people. He's saying, like, look, there are people in the world that their only god is their belly. They're basically animals. They're living on instincts. The idol of experience is what guides them. And he says, look, their end is destruction. If you, like, your whole life is just built around the things of this earth, then you're going to become earthly, and you're going to perish along with the earth. But, he says, our citizenship is in heaven, and from it we await a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who will transform our lowly body to be like his glorious body, by the power that enables him even to subject all things to himself. And so, not only is an experience of knowing God the only experience that's going to satisfy you, but the experience of knowing God is the only experience that's going to really change you for the better. The more that you pursue these earthly experiences, the more you're going to become like the earth and the things of this world. But the more that you pursue a relationship with God, the more you're going to become like God. And one day you're going to be changed to be like the Lord and to be where he is. Jesus warns in Luke chapter 12 and verse 15, take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. You know, we talked about at the very beginning of this class that covetousness is idolatry, and we can covet things, we can covet people, we can also covet experiences. And when Jesus says one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions, we might also think about how one's life does not consist in the abundance of his experiences. You know, you are a lot more than the stuff that you own. And you are also a lot more than the Instagram stories that you have, or the TikTok videos that you post, or your social media feed, whatever flavor you might choose, right? That your life is a lot more than just the stuff that you have or the things that you experience. And it's easy for us to forget that. One last passage that I want to close with. Jeremiah chapter 9. God makes it very clear that if you want to focus on an experience, if there's something that is an experience that you can't live without, it's this. He says, let not the wise man boast in his wisdom. Let not the mighty man boast in his might. Let not the rich man boast in his riches. But let him who boasts boast in this, that he understands and knows me, that I am the Lord who practices steadfast love, justice, and righteousness in the earth. For in these things I delight, declares the Lord. So that's the thought that I want to leave you with, is I want you to be able to see through the idols of experience, whether we're talking about sinful experiences that the world pursues, or even non-sinful experiences that the world is so obsessed with. And I want you to see that there is an experience that is worth pursuing. There is an experience that is worth building your whole life around. And it's understanding and knowing God. That's the thing that Jesus can offer. That's the thing that Jesus told the woman at the well, that if you have this thing, you're going to finally be satisfied. And so think about your life. Think about what you do with your time. Think about the things that are most important to you. Are you worshiping an idol of experience, whether it's sinful or non-sinful? Or are you actually pursuing the experience of knowing and understanding God? So any other comments before we leave? Okay, I know that was a lot to take in. I appreciate you guys. Thanks for being here. And we'll call it done. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to show this. My mom's still